Hello, my friends. Welcome to the Addiction Medicine Made Easy podcast, where we take topics in addiction medicine and break them down into digestible nuggets and clinical pearls that you can use at the bedside. Dr. Casey Grover here as your host once again. All right, everyone. I am so glad to have you back for another episode. Before we start, thank you again to Montage Health and the Montage Health Foundation for their support of my quest to improve this podcast and produce fun and engaging education for healthcare providers on addiction. And I just want to acknowledge that my focus for this podcast is to educate healthcare providers on the topic of addiction. But you might not be a healthcare provider. You might be a person living with addiction, or a person whose family member has an addiction, or just a person wanting to learn more about addiction. No matter who you are, I am glad to have you with me. We as humanity have a lot of work to do on making the treatment of addiction more accessible. So, with that, on to today's episode. The topic of today's episode is a novel approach to the treatment of methamphetamine use disorder, and I am really excited for this episode. I'm going to do a little reflection as I introduce this topic. I have been doing this podcast now for, believe it or not, 3 years. The vast majority of episodes for the first 2 years were just me researching a topic on PubMed and sharing what I found. I call those monologue episodes. But as time has gone by, I've been doing more interviews. I actually really like both episode styles, and I hope you do too. If you have a preference on which type you like better, or you want to share any feedback in general about this podcast, please drop me an email. You can reach me at ammadeeasy@fastmail.com. That's F-A-S-T, fastmail.com. Now, today's episode is going to be an interview. And it's an interview with Dr. Michael Miller, who is a general surgeon turned pain and addiction medicine doctor. He reached out to me on LinkedIn wanting to share some incredible work that he is doing on stimulant use disorder, most specifically methamphetamine use disorder. And I've actually seen him in action. He's actually worked with me and one of my patients via Zoom. So, we're going to get started with this interview. Two brief things to look out for before we start. First, there are one or two minor uses of adult language. Second, we recorded this interview on Zoom. Overall, it was great, but there are a few minor skips in the audio. And with that, let's get started. Dr. Miller, welcome to the Addiction Medicine Made Easy podcast. Please tell us about yourself and how you got into addiction medicine.
Thank you very much. I love the Addiction Medicine Made Easy. You know, I'm a board certified general surgeon. And so the question is, you know, how do you go from there to addiction? And to be succinct, which rarely happens, I moved from general surgery into advanced wound care, which I've really been doing about 30 years. And based on experiences with my own family doc, a DO in Pennsylvania, he made house calls. And so for me, this was the way medicine was done. It was delivered to the patient on their terms. And so made a lot of wound care house calls. From there, realized that these patients need a lot more. Wound care wasn't enough if they're homebound. Brought in some palliative care providers, then realized these folks have a lot of pain if they're homebound. And so started a pain management program, brought that into the office. And after seeing far too many cases of 6 and 8 and 10 Percocet a day, and all sorts of outrageous. I see you smiling. Yes, you're familiar. Said, you know, I need to learn addiction. And through interactions with people like yourself and voracious reading, and I'm the little kid that always asks why. And in answering my whys, finally said, you know, this is not rocket scientist. If I act intelligently and ethically, we should be able to help a lot of people. And indeed, it's turned out that way. And it's been 7 years of doing about 50 to 60% of the practice now is addiction.
Yeah. So you and I have been corresponding about your work, and you have some incredible results with methamphetamine use disorder. Can you just tell me about some of the successes you've been having in treating methamphetamine use disorder?
Yeah, it's outrageous. And again, I jokingly say, and I'm a huge egotist, by the way, as my wife of 40 years will tell you. And I say, look, I'm a pretty smart boy, but I can't be that smart. And it turns out I am. Basically, I jokingly tell patients that the reason we are so successful is that we do something very, very unusual in a medical practice. We make a diagnosis. And again, tongue in cheek and humorous, I don't treat if I don't have a very, very good idea. And the meth stuff started basically by asking, as I said previously, why? Why would anyone use meth? Opioids are easy. If you're mentally ill, you've got anxiety. Anxiety hurts. Depression hurts. Bipolar hurts. That's pain. And so you're going to use pain medicine to treat it. Hence fentanyl, heroin, what have you, street opioids. But meth? Why would anybody want to rev themselves up into a frenzy? That made no sense to me. And then I said, okay, why would meth ever be used? Well, meth actually is a DEA category class 2.
Yep.
It's legal.
Yes.
It's legal for ADD. It's legal for weight loss. And then I said, all right, what about historically? Well, the Nazi Reichstag, the oversight for, they use that in their meetings to stay awake and energetic. My understanding is that in the Philippines, they use methamphetamine to increase worker productivity. And of course, World War II, the Japanese kamikaze pilots used a methamphetamine cogener to give them the arousal and energy to get there. So having recognized that there were actually some real indications for it, started to ask patients why. And it was just, what does it do for you? You know, as I said, I'm a simple, intelligent guy. You know, what does it do for you? And I kept hearing, well, it gives me energy. It gives me arousal. It gives me stuff. And then I started to look at the ADHD stuff. And you and I both know there's lots of patients on stimulants. A different topic. I don't believe in the H in adults. Little kids, 8-year-olds, I can talk H all day, but I published a treatise in LinkedIn saying, let's get the H out of here. I love puns. And the point was that adults cannot have ADHD as such. ADD, we can talk about all day, and I believe in that. So then it was a matter of, well, we got to move away from the stimulants. And to kind of cut to the chase, basically, it was a matter of saying, well, what are they getting? What kind of effects? What are the presentations? And once we get these presentations, let's look at how better to treat them. And through luck and a little bit of skill, came to this. And it has been, I hate to be disingenuous, this has been the easiest thing I've ever done. It's easy. It doesn't require a lot of aggressive questioning. These patients, in most cases, give you their diagnosis if you listen.
And you told me you're seeing incredible rates in reducing methamphetamine use. What numbers are you seeing as far as reduction in meth use?
Well, our statistical rate is 86%. And I'll say that again, because it's a pretty unbelievable number. We have an 86% success rate mitigating cravings and use of methamphetamine. We also have a few cocaines and cracks thrown in there. Because we were looking at stimulant overall, though meth is obviously our main thrust. 86% mitigation of use and cravings at 72 hours after initiation of therapy. And that number extends to the 3-month monitoring point, 86%.
I mean, that is like an earthquake in addiction medicine. That is incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as I said, I'm doing it and I still have trouble believing it. But Dr. Guang Zhou, an eminent PhD statistician at the Marion University College of Osteopathic Medicine here in Indianapolis, and Dr. David Strom, who's the head of the Department of Physiology, are good friends and said, let's look at the data. And you can imagine my overwhelming surprise, because I knew anecdotally it was working, but yeah, anecdotal, unfortunately, is not a reliable source. And when the boys came up and said, you're not going to believe these numbers. And again, you look at the data and some weeks better, some months better, but overall 86%. And that's for the two major categories of stimulant abusers or methamphetamine that we've identified.
Yeah. So talk me through your algorithm at the very highest level. Kind of give me an overview of how you approach patients with stimulant use.
Basically, we, you know, and again, when you're not a psychiatrist and learning addiction, you know, you keep things simple. As I said, I'm the little kid that asks why. And so basically from talking to these patients, I basically kept hearing the same stories, but two different stories. And this category one and this category two, there was virtually no overlap. My category one people, I named Lisa, low internal state of arousal. And my category two people, based on just their presentation, and this was reproducible to the nth degree. I mean, no matter who I talk to, they are either one or two. There are some rare exceptions that we can talk about that do not fit. But for primary, and I want to emphasize that, primary methamphetamine or stimulant abusers, where I say, what's your drug of choice? If I put everything in front of you, what would you pick? If they say meth or crack or cocaine, I got them.
Okay, so let's talk about that first one, the Lisa. Mm-hmm. How do you diagnose that? How do you treat that?
You know, again, it's based on the presentation. Lisa stands for low internal state of arousal. I tell lay people and others, substitute the word energy if you want for arousal. But I think in terms of brain activity, not physical activity. And basically what we discovered is these Lisa patients had no major personality aberrancies. They are some of the nicest people. And to sidebar for a second, everybody knows one of these two categories, whether they use meth or not. The universality is outrageous. So my category ones are the nicest people you meet. They're friendly. They're warm. They have a great joke. You enjoy being with them. However, they have absolutely no trustworthiness. They are always late to work. If the boss says, can you stay late because we got more? No, I can't stay late. Or they look at the clock. They take 10 and 20 cigarette and pee breaks during a work day. They have no arousal. And they will tell you, you don't. You know, the workup is simple. I basically ask them, what do you do for a living? I'm a waitress at a restaurant. How many waitresses are there? 10. Okay. Who's the best waitress that you work with? Who's the best waitress that you know? My category one leases are never the best waitress, and they'll admit it. There's always somebody better, and they come in late. And this, and I ask her, whether or not you were using meth on that day, or even prior, interestingly, no, yeah, and it's embarrassing for them. So I'm very, very complimentary. But I say, you know, I appreciate your answers. And no, I'm always late, and I don't stay late, and I've jumped jobs. They are the most untrustworthy people. If they tell you they're going to pick you up for something at 4 o'clock, 6:30, you're calling them saying, where are you? And they have absolutely no arousal. They will tell you, my house is a mess. I get out of bed and I can't clean. I go to work and I need a break. It's outrageous. And it is actually about 10, 15% of all methamphetamine users, stimulant abusers, are category one based on our review of our statistics and numbers.
So now you've made the diagnosis. What does one do to treat this subtype?
Well, as I said, I am anti-amphetamines in adults. I think that is the most disingenuous thing that can be done. We can get into the argument about why the category ADHD for the American psychiatric is a horrible and needs to be changed to just ADD. And then ADHD juvenile, ADD, adolescent, and then ADD inattentive. But different story. For now, basically, it was a matter of how do I increase their arousal without giving them stimulants? And so we, in talking to some eminent psychiatrists, my dearest friend who's a sleep medicine doc, I said, well, what do? These people, they have no energy. And the answer was simple. And everybody gave me the same. One, Provigil. modafinil. Okay. If I can't get Provigil, then Nuvigil, but some sort of arousal increasing. Those are actually indicated for narcolepsy, multiple sclerosis, and shift worker syndrome. So that's the excuse we use, and we get it approved. And we're dosing them to start at 100 milligrams of Provigil twice a day, because you got to make this easy for them. The second medicine was, all right, what do I do about increasing arousal? Because I don't believe in the magic pill concept. I dual treat everything. Second medicine we looked at was Wellbutrin, because we had so many patients, because we have in-house MAT. I have in-house psychiatry and in-house mental health who have taught me tons. And I kept hearing the Wellbutrin, I don't get any sleep at night. It keeps me awake. My brain keeps racing. And I thought, oh my gosh, another non-stimulating, non-stimulant stimulant. So we put them on Wellbutrin 100 twice a day with the potential to go up or down. And if they have previously had a bad experience with Wellbutrin, we go with mirtazapine, Remeron, 15 milligrams at bedtime or 30 if they need it. And with that, two pills a day and then two Wellbutrin or two in one, the outrageous for my category ones, once we've made the diagnosis.
Wow. Okay. So let's go on to the second category. What is the second category? How do you make the diagnosis?
The second category, and again, this is all, you know, uneducated, what's the best? I call it CAP with lots of A's. It's chronic, aggressive, agitated, absent, attendant presentation. And after seeing these patients and hearing it, I've had one of those moments of clarity. And basically, it's ADD. It's ADD. It's classic ADD. It the problem is that no one ever makes the diagnosis correctly. And after doing this for years, and so to cut to the chase, these people, one, they are hyper-emotional. The road rage that we all read about and see in the newspaper, those people have ADD. They do. There's no question about it. They may have other things, but they got ADD because those people, they get hyper-emotional, bang. And to use a vulgarity on the air here, the question I ask them is, one, do you have a significant relationship? When was your last significant relationship? And they'll say, well, I'm in the middle of it now or whatever. And the second question I ask is, if I were to call that significant other and ask them whether or not you are the world's biggest bitch, what would they say? And yeah, I mean, there's always a reluctance to admit one's peccadilloes, but in this case, yeah. And I say, you understand what I mean by that word. You know, you get angry for no reason. You may lash out. Yeah. Yeah. And huge majority, 99%+. Yes, they do. The opposite can be true. If not an anger response, it's a, and I've never learned a good word for it. It's the opposite where there something mean is said to them. You're ugly. You're dumb. Are you wearing that? Why did you do that? And they actually have a, and again, I've never found the right word, a sadness, the inability to accept a criticism of some sort. Mm. And these people collapse. They will tell you, no, I don't get it. You know, when I use the word bitch, they go, no. When my wife, fiance, friends, whatever, get on me, I'm leaving. I'll run away. I'll walk away until I get a chance to calm down. This unfiltered, uncontrollable hyper-emotionality. The second component is, and this is my favorite, was I'll say, you know, obviously you're an intelligent person. Notice the finger use. Very intelligent person, high school, college, whatever it is, always complimentary. So you and I are having this conversation and I'm asking you these crazy questions. How often when you're talking to somebody, do you suddenly airhead, space cadet, astronaut, dits, and they like all the time? Say, so you forget what you're talking about, even if you started the conversation. And the answer is almost always, yeah, yeah. Say, does it bother you? Because you're obviously intelligent. Yeah, it kills me. Do they pick on you for that? Yeah. So the loss of continuity of thought is what I call that. They're airheads. And it's interesting because that's the most prevalent feature. I've had more than one patient where we were interviewing them and say, very nice to meet you. I've got a bunch of questions. Do you have any questions about what's going on? And this one lady said, no, wait a minute. I just forgot what we're talking about.
Right on cue.
Am I, And my staff is funny because they're in the room and they're well-educated. They hold up fingers based on what category. It was like something and let's make a deal. This lady, oh my God, I forgot. And everyone went like this. Two. And I'm like, do you want me to continue the, no. Yeah, I'll continue it. That's fine. Just to firm it up. You almost felt bad for them. So the loss of continuity of thought, the hypermotionality, and the last one, the attendant, is these people lock in. I'm sitting there doing something and it's Michael, what? Well, I'm trying to get your attention. Well, I heard you. Oh yeah. What was I saying? Well, it doesn't matter. I don't agree with you and leave me alone. I'm trying to do this. And they have that anger over response, but they lock in and you need dynamite to get them out. And when I get two of those characteristics, they got ADD. And again, the funniest part is I tell people I'm not treating methamphetamine. That's a lovely byproduct. I'm treating the underlying etiologic causalities for why people use stimulants to self-treat. That's my byline.
So what does one treat category two with?
ADD meds. And again, stimulants off the table, off the table. We were using Lilly's atomoxetine, Strattera, and with great results, lovely results. The problem was you had a lot of attendant nausea with it, and I had to convince them that vomiting driving their car was acceptable. It went away, and that was a hard sell, but it worked. And then we discovered a new medicine called Qelbree, Q-E-L-B-R-E-E. Forgive me, I forgot who the manufacturer is. It's very common. And we use Qelbree. And as I said, I don't believe in a magic bullet. We have had extraordinary success adding guanfacine ER, 10X, Intuniv. They're all the same names. And I start them at 4 milligrams of that. The Qelbree is 100 milligram capsule, and they're this big, once a day for a week. And then we go to either 400 caps, you know, a two and two, a one and one, 200 and 200, 400 a day after that. Or if it's too much, we drop them and they have 100 milligram version. So it's one guanfacine ER in the morning and whatever dose of Qelbree they're on. And as I said, you got to make it easy for these people. So in category one, it's either two and two or two and one. And in category two, it's 3 a.m. That's it. And I tell them, is this something you're able to do? And in almost all cases, it's like, yeah, I can do that.
What if somebody doesn't fall into either subtype?
Fabulous question. we have had some that I can't help. And it's funny because, as I said, it's primary methamphetamine use, primary stimulant abuse. Is this your drug of choice? Yes. The categories or exceptions are one, the male homosexual population uses methamphetamine as a sexual stimulant. Yes, I have treated a lot of gay men who are using it for the initial reasons, but that seems to be a prevalence for better or worse, and there's not much you can do about that. The second people that we had were interesting. One was a gentleman that had 5 children from 5 different baby mamas. And this gentleman basically was using meth for his warehouse job, and he was double, triple the production of anybody else. And that was a real ethical dilemma, because as a father of two, I said to him, you know, father to father, I have to give you a ton of credit that you are stepping up to take care of these 5 unrelated children. That's manning up, my friend. However, as addictionologist Dr. Michael Miller, we got to figure out a better way, because you can't. The other gentleman was a little similar. He loved money, loved new clothes, loved cars, loved his apartment. He would take methamphetamine in the morning in the warehouse to double, triple everyone else's. But his friends were then giving him the oxycodone at night to slow him down.
Interesting.
So to date, those are the two exceptions, these guys that are monetary driven and those that are sexual driven. Otherwise, the 99%+ fit into category one and two. And it is amazing. The overlap is minimal. Rarely is someone have both. And usually it's a category one that might present with some category two. But I've never seen category twos present as category one. I can't recall any of that.
Do you have any overlap where people fall into both?
No. No. Other than, as I said, occasionally my category ones with no arousal will tell me that, you know, I have some trouble concentrating. In that case, we have put patients on the Qelbree when they show with an ADD. Mm. But as I said, my backup is I've got psychiatry and mental health counseling. So I make my diagnosis and then I am talking to my team and saying, what do you think? Here's what they're complaining about. The key, however, my team is told is that when I start a treatment for the underlying causes, that treatment is to be considered put in a concrete box, 5 feet thick walls, surrounded by electrical fencing and you know, steel. You are not to change my protocol meds without talking to me. Anything else you need, we got. I had someone comment on concerns about Wellbutrin and increasing anxiety. And I said, I appreciate that. I've not had it happen, but my team is acutely aware. And were that to happen, we'd look at some other alternatives.
Yeah, makes sense. How did you actually come up with these medication regimens? I mean, I've never heard of Qelbree. I had to look it up. I believe it's Viloxazine is the generic name. How did you come up with these regimens?
Well, the first two, as I said, I had the great fortune of meeting and talking with a lot of experts, some psychiatric friends of mine. My dearest friend, Dr. Eric Nugent out of Wisconsin, is a sleep medicine doc. And he's the one that said, well, shoot, you know, if they're not, you know, narcolepsy and whatever, you need to think about modafinil. Two of my psychiatrists recommended it with the admonition of potential for addiction. Though, again, yeah, pick your poison, meth or modafinil, right?
Right.
And so with these four or five people helping me out, it was like, okay, we're going to start with modafinil. We're going to start with the Wellbutrin and or the Remeron, mirtazapine and C. And, you know, through luck and guile, it has been a game changer for my ones. Category two, everybody knows somebody with ADD, and recognizing that there was no way I was giving out stimulants, looked the Strattera atomoxetine. We had a lot of experience within the practice other than the side effects. And one day this rep showed up and said, hey, I got this new medicine for ADHD in adults. And after I bit my tongue with the H, got more information and said, oh my gosh, this is a game changer. And so we have moved them for some reasons over to the Qelbree. When the Qelbree doesn't work, we use the Strattera. 60 milligrams is the starting dose for the Strattera atomoxetine. And then I'll go up or down. So there is some maneuverability, but it was just through luck and guile and having colleagues that were much smarter than I who said, hey, why don't you think about this? And 7 years later, it is working unbelievably.
Yeah. So 86% success rate. Again, amazing.
Yeah.
What are you doing with the 14%?
Fabulous question. Because, and I'm going to use that bad word again, anecdotally, I would tell you anecdotally, it's 99%. The reason the statistics are 86 is because of the infamous friends, because the we have a 2 week run-in. So when they start the medications, we don't count the data until they've been on the medicines religiously for 2 weeks. Then they come in and then we're checking urines and everything. And then that 72-hour mark is when did the meds start working? And usually it's, oh, 2-3 days afterwards. And we were able to kind of cone it down to the 72. But at 2 weeks, when they are not successful, the overwhelming reason at the 2 week point is they didn't get the meds. Mm. Well, they only had the Qelbree. They didn't have the guanfacine, or, you know, I was uncomfortable taking both. And when I hear that, I know why. And it's like, please pick your poison, take this, give me 2 weeks. And if you're not craving, then the proof's in the pudding. But I use the word friends because what happens is the infamous friends come over, or they go over to see their friends.
Understood.
And they say, well, you know, my friend came over and son of a gun, I have this baggie of meth in my person. I was going to use it. You know, you don't, I know you're trying to quit. And most of these people are so nice and sociable and they don't want to hurt their friend's feelings. So they do meth with them because when they come in and it's positive, the phrase I use sarcastically is, please tell me that they held you down and inserted it into you. Because if you can tell me that, then we've got an easy fix. Most of the time they go no, and they laugh and say no. And it's, I say, were you craving? Oh God, no, I haven't been craving since I started the medication. So why did you do it? And of course, the universal answer, I don't know.
Yeah, as I say in addiction medicine is a team sport, or treating addiction is a team sport.
Oh God, yeah.
And it's the bad team. It's the friends, as you say. Yeah, makes perfect sense. So let's say this person's in the 86%, the success. How long are you keeping people on these regimens?
Hardest question. And looking at all the research, it was like, how long? And you know, you and I being in the same profession, 3 months is about all anybody ever talks about. You know, if the research goes beyond 3 months, I'm not sure I trust it. And so we have tracked them hard for 3 months. And you'll see on the statistics, anyone that wants them, I am thrilled to send you our data. Delighted. Criticism is beyond appreciated. At the 3 month point, they fall off. I am aware that we have some that are at the 2 and 3 year point who we talk to every 6 months. Their family doctor has agreed to take over the medication regimen and they're doing fabulous. But you and I both know they move, you lose them, they forget. Interestingly, we have a modest number that will call us 6 and 8 months later and say, I need to come back. I'm using meth again. And you know, your treatment worked so, so well. I don't know why I started, or, you know, I had a crisis or whatever. I'm coming back. So the longevity, 3 months is about all I can honestly talk about. But when they're coming back, they are saying it worked great. Yeah. That's why I'm coming back. I need it.
Be nice to make some of this stuff long-acting injectable the way we have.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, I would love it.
Yeah.
I would, because, you know, the pills, the... And again, we make it easy. It's, you know, category one is 2 and 2 or 2 and 1. How much easier? And it's first thing, you know, and category two is 2 and 1. And it's first thing in the morning. It's, you know, you don't need to take pills all day.
Yeah, well said. So you've kind of hinted at it, but obviously this research is incredible. What are your plans in terms of publishing or presenting? We got to get the word out here.
Well, I will tell you, and as I jokingly said up front, I'm a huge egotist. And I don't broke fools well. And the problem is, much like working with you, which has been extraordinary, I've had the great honor of doing podcasts with Aaron Weiner, PhD, very prolific, Mark Leeds, DO, 2 and 3 and 4 other podcasts, including one with a former DEA agent. Brilliant, brilliant man. And the problem is the response has been over the top and then it dies. You can hear the crickets chirping in the background. I keep saying, look, if you don't believe me, call me a liar. Please have the respect to say you're lying. I don't believe it, because then it gives me a chance to show you the data and then you can judge objectively. It's not even happening. I have reached out to journalists all over who publish an article and say methamphetamine crisis horrible. ASAM, American Academy of Psychiatry, they have no answer. And I reach out and say, I have an 86% success rate. I will send you my data. I'll send you my work. And crickets. So to answer your question, now that we have rock solid data, rock solid statistics, it's been reviewed. We are looking for publication. I have PhDs who have agreed to go over the work to make sure it is pristine. It is bulletproof. And then we're going to look for someone to publish it, because this information is needed. As you're aware, the only therapy or treatment they're talking about is contingency management, which is a mental health therapy. My pet name for it is bribery. You are bribing them and saying, if you don't use meth, I'll let you put your hand in the prize bag and bring out a teddy bear, a movie ticket, or a have a nice day sticker. And the other problem with that is it requires a lot of training to do it well. And the statistics for contingency management are 17% success, 17%. And the problem is homogeneity. When you look at the stuff, even from ASAM, the 200 studies and pages, everyone is saying, you're using meth, try this. You're using meth, try this. There's been no attempt at breaking the homogeneity assumption. And as I said, I'm the little kid that asks why. and I got my why. There are two major categories of subcategories of stimulant abusers. Are there more? Well, you know, you heard my exceptions. We are looking for other categories. And in fact, in the paper, I said, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But so far, it's not very prevalent. And again, the 86% success rate tells me that we're onto something very good. Now the issue is to get the word out and teach other people. This is not rocket science. I mean, I'm doing these via Zoom all over. Doctor calls me and says, I have a patient on meth. Would you mind working them up? You bet. You know, you can charge for it. I don't have to. And let's see what you think. And the feedback has been unbelievable. We just got to get it out there. I agree. And we are. I use the we because I have a nurse practitioner associate who I've trained, and she's doing the same thing. Some subtle differences, but the same workup, same protocol.
Yeah. Ever since you and I connected, I have been doing loads of research on, you know, ADD, ADHD, learning about the meds. I've got several patients I'm trying on your regimen. I've been very frustrated by the lack of treatment options for methamphetamine, and I'm really excited. I think there's an enormous signal here. So
I'm thrilled. You know, yeah. And that's been my issue is I'm so angry at the medical community. As I said, if you're going to call me a liar, call me a liar. If you don't believe me, don't believe me. But ignoring something with this outrageous statistic, 86%, is crazy. It's crazy. Take a look at it. Decide for yourself. That's all we ask.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. And I don't know if this helps at all with research, but I remember when I was a medical student, I published a study. And ironically, my finding is I had an 86% success rate in reducing emergency department visits because of an intervention.
And it's fabulous.
When I reframed the title and I called it a pilot study, I got published simply because I didn't know what I was doing and my research techniques were very, very primitive. But I think the idea is that, you know, early research often, you know, it's hypothesis generating. I certainly wish I had, you know, gotten some courses on biostatistics in medical school. But I just got to say, clinician to clinician, kudos on your work. Super excited that you put the thought into it. Ask the whys. You're helping me in my practice. I'm starting to, you know, learn more about this, and I've got some patients I'm trying on this regimen. So, like I said, clinician to clinician, thank you. Your work will help my patients. So,
and again, for the sake of this, knowing you've got a huge following, post my contact information. You know, our website is Miller Care Group. I made that easy for my own purposes. And it's doc@millercaregroup.com. Ask questions. I will talk on the phone for hours with anyone, send you the data, let you judge for yourself. We have to get this treated because every time I pick up yet another article, it's exponentially expanding. And of course, with all the crap they're putting in it, the fentanyl, whatever, the deaths are outrageous and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And here I am, this lone voice in Indianapolis, Indiana, board certified in general surgery. A lot of heads being scratched saying, really? And the answer is, yeah, really.
Yeah. Well, cool. As we wrap up, is there anything else you want to add about this novel approach you're working on to treating stimulant use disorder?
No, we have been trying to get the word out. And that's my goal, is anyone with questions. And I can't tell you, Doc, how much I appreciate your taking the time to go over this with me and get the word out. This is right now free. I mean, I'm happy to teach. If you need to know if these are patients you're treating, I'm happy to show you. This is not proprietary. This is medical science. You know, the old thing about standing on the shoulders of those to see farther. I'm 5'2", so you're not going to see that much farther. But, anybody we can help, we will help without any reservation, any stipulations. We are thrilled to help, and that's the goal. And thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, appreciate your time, and thank you for what you do.
You are very welcome.
And that is the end of this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for what you do. And please don't forget, treating substance use disorders saves lives.